Welcome to the In Defense of Ska podcast.
There's a lot of like, okay, well, you like ska, name three bands that aren't the Boss Tones.
I'm your host, Aaron Carnes, music journalist and author of the book In Defense of Ska.
And I'm your co-host, Adam Davis, veteran ska musician from the bands Omnigon and Link 80.
On our show, we aim to push back on the mainstream's negative perception of ska music.
There are so many great untold stories throughout the history of ska. The show features interviews with everyone from the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones to Fishbone, Fall Out Boy singer Patrick Stump, and the Police drummer Stuart Copeland. Join us on In Defense of Ska from the Consequence Podcast Network.
There are some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a large unexpected inheritance. An always-on-the-verge-of-death phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone, up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard, so you can get a new one. Just trade in any phone from our top brands on any unlimited plan. With new line on my plan, additional terms apply for trade-in and pay off your phone offer. See Verizon.com for details.
Owning a boat comes with a number of perks, like being able to say, ahoy, or land ho, and not feel weird about it. So here's another perk. GEICO's boat insurance offers access to the largest towing fleet on the water. And with specialist support from agents that are as passionate about boating as you are, there's so much value that you'll want to say, shiver me timbers, and not feel weird about that either. Get more with GEICO.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Hey, welcome to another edition of Kyle Meredith with... It's the interview series presented by WFPK at WFPK.org, Consequence and the Consequence Podcast Network. Thanks for making your way here for checking out the episode. If you're not already, hit that subscribe button. I'll send you three new interviews just like this one every single week. It's a new one every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Great way to keep up with your favorite artists, discover some new ones, and we make it easy. You can grab us anywhere you get your podcasts from. Spotify, Apple Podcast, NPR, WFPK.org, Consequence, YouTube for the video versions, or anywhere you get your podcasts, you can subscribe to Kyle Meredith with. Please do give the series a rating and leave a review while you're at it as well. We've had some great guests on lately. Judith Light, you know, from Who's the Boss and The Menu. Courtney Taylor was here. They both talked about a Disney movie called Out of My Mind. And we also had Richard Curtis, the man behind Love Actually, Four Weddings and a Funeral in Notting Hill, to talk about his new Christmas movie, That Christmas, out now on Netflix. Claire Forlani and John Tenney dropped by to talk about Cruel Intentions, the TV series, out now on Prime. We had legendary filmmaker John Waters here, Tori Amos, Martin Cove from Cobra Kai and Karate Kid, Maren Morris, Susanna Hoffs from the Bengals, Adele, Hank Azaria from The Simpsons, just an example of what you get when you subscribe to the Kyle Meredith With podcast. That's me, Kyle Meredith. Today, it's a very special episode, a rewind episode. My interviews, four of them, with REM. Almost all of them with Mike, well, all of them with Mike Mills. One of them included Michael Stipe. We're going to go through the history through this entire episode, starting in 2011. It was REM's finale. They were releasing their greatest hits. They had just said that they would not be a band anymore. So that's right. My beginning with REM starts with their ending. Of course, my love for REM goes all the way back to my beginning. My coming of age years. They were one of the bands that changed my life. They were one of the bands when I heard Bang and Blame from the album Monster, everything changed. And they are one of my all-time favorites. And when I say that, I mean they are one of my all-time favorites. They are tied. They are a three-way tie for number one. So with all that said, let's get into this. This is part one, talking with Mike Mills back in 2011. It's Kyle Meredith with REM.
Putting together the compilation, it looks like you beat Warner Brothers to the punch by preparing all of this before you even announced your split. Is that accurate? Did you guys know that this was going to happen? Like, all right, we're going to split up and the label's going to want the greatest hits, and here we go.
Well, the greatest hits was something, or the compilation, the retrospective, actually, which is a more accurate term for what it is. No, we knew that was coming. That's been on the burner for some time. As far as breaking up, we started talking about that on the 2008 tour, and it really began to crystallize you know, between the end of that and then the making of Collapse Into Now. So I think it was a really nice sort of coincidence, synergistic thing that the breakup of the band coincided with a retrospective that was already going to happen anyway.
When you were putting this together, did you consider any alternate takes or song or production bonuses? Are there any in there for us to find? That because that happened back on the 80s compilation too, didn't it?
Yeah, we threw some curveballs in there, but this one is really, you know, there are a couple of ways to look at it. I always think of, you know, the Martian who lands on Earth after the nuclear war, and there's nothing left except this two CD set of REM songs, and you know, we're going for that Martian market, and so he listens to it and goes, oh, okay, this was a pretty good band. Or, more realistically, for some 12-year-old kid who's just getting into music, and he's heard of this band REM, but he wants to know what they're all about. And if you listen to this, it pretty much covers all the bases for us. So it was actually, you know, not a really hard compilation to put together, and I think it represents us really well, especially the three new songs, because that's pretty much what REM sounds like in 2011.
As you were looking back, can you name any one single song that you think defines REM? I mean, here you're saying here's two discs that defines REM. Is there that quintessential REM track?
You know, that is a question that normally I would say no. We do too many kinds of music. Our songs are more diverse than you can really pin down. But I've sort of changed my mind on that, and I will throw out Man on the Moon as a song that pretty much captures what REM is about. You know, it's incredible lyrics. It's musically brilliant, I think. It's got a lot of great harmony singing on it. It's a fun song, and yet it's emotionally powerful. I would put that up as a pretty good indicator.
I suddenly imagine that alien coming to Earth being a radio programmer who says, I've got 30 seconds, tell me one song.
You know, I don't know how they do things on Mars, but it might be like that.
I wanted to ask you about one specific record, and I think it's been one of the more interesting records of your career, and that was number 13 with Around the Sun. That's one that I think was probably not just kind of critically panned, but it seemed like that was the one time where the band said, oops. But you turned around, and then with when the live record that came out right after it, almost all of those songs was redeemed, and I was just kind of wondering if you had made up with that album.
Well, I don't mind that album. Here's the thing about it. It's there are great songs on that record, as you can tell by the live record that came after that. The mm-hmm. the songs themselves are great. I mean, there's some of them that I'd put up against anything else. But we just made a mistake in logistics. We thought it'd be okay to start that record and then take a break in the middle and record a couple of new songs for another, you know, the first greatest hits compilation, and then go on tour for that for months, and then try to come back and finish the record. And the fact is that's not the way you make records. Mm-hmm. You start the record, you work on it, and you finish it. And that's just a lesson that we learned. So what happened was, you know, we when we left, we were very excited about that record. And then we got back from the tour and tried to go back in the studio and finish it. And we just really didn't have a focus. We didn't know where it was supposed to go or how to get it there. And we tried all these different things and ended up maybe trying too many things. And so at the end, we had a record that was just unfocused and unrealized, which was kind of sad because those songs deserved better. And in fact, they got it on the live record.
Yeah, and they really have sounded great every time I've heard them, too. So thank you for the clearance on that. A band gets to a point in their life, as REM has, when they start influencing other bands. And you guys have been doing that now for a very long time. When you hear of a new band coming out saying, yeah, they sound like REM. But it seems always around that time that, you know, and maybe I'm wrong, you're the one who actually gets interviewed here, but that interviewers stop asking the whole question of, you know, what are your current influences yourself? Because here you are influencing every other band. And I was curious about that, you know, if there is something right now that's redefining your tastes, and maybe it's not even music, maybe it's a movie or book or a piece of art, but as you further yourself along here, what are you listening to or seeing that's really keeping you creative?
Wow. Oh, man, of course, that's when I get brain freeze, when I really want to tell about all the things I'm listening to. You know, I'm excited about that new Lars von Trier movie, Melancholia. That looks exciting to me. I heard a song by a band called Real Estate that I have just downloaded their LP, and I haven't listened to it yet, but I'm excited about that because I like the song It's Real.
Oh, yeah. And a good video about dogs.
Oh, is it?
All about dogs.
I look forward to that. You know, the Low Anthem are doing some really fun stuff. You know, Wilco is certainly carrying the flag for one of the best American bands out there. The Jayhawks are back together. That makes me very excited. You know, there are plenty of fun things out there and exciting, both old and new.
Yeah. You all, of course, this all ends amicably, but are you going to miss REM? Do you expect that you're going to miss REM, or are you just ready? Is this it? You're ready to move on?
What I'll miss is performing on stage, because, you know, the thing that makes a band is the chemistry that occurs when a certain group of people make music together. I mean, you could find five people that are tremendous players, but if they don't have that chemistry, it just doesn't matter. But the fact is, with Peter and Michael and I, and with Peter and Bill and Michael and I, there was something that happened, and you could feel it, and it was very real, and certainly that aspect of it I'll miss. Everything else, we're all perfectly at peace about it. You know, we walked away on our own terms at the timing and the placing all of it was all our idea. And so, you know, no regrets about that at all. But of course, I'll miss singing and playing with those guys.
Are you working on a solo record?
I'm not currently working on a solo record, but, you know, who knows what's going to happen. There's all kind of musical things floating around for next year. And I imagine at some point in my career, I'll sit down and put some stuff together and put out the Mike Mills Experience featuring Mike Mills.
Do you think it's going to be, I mean, it's obviously, I guess, going to be different for you to transition into a front man when that time gets here?
Well, that's certainly one of the things you have to think about. I'm not a front man. I don't have, you know, I don't have that kind of charisma. I don't have that kind of desire or whatever it is it takes to be a front man. I don't think I have it. So that's why I was always perfectly happy, you know, with being in a band and not being the front man. And just because you put out a record doesn't mean you have to tour. You can make a record without ever leaving your house. But that just remains to be seen. Who knows? You know, I may get this burst of ego and creativity and say, go out and be a front man. Maybe I'll do that. But that remains to be seen.
Yeah. Well, I certainly do look forward to every single thing we're going to hear from you. I mean, obviously, this is not the end of Mike Mills right here, but the
certainly
beginning,
not.
Right? It's the beginning.
It is. You know, it is the beginning of a whole new phase. I mean, everybody's very excited about it. You know, Michael's going to, you know, I think he likes his visual arts, and he'll work with sculpture and photography and things in the art world. And you know, Peter will continue to play music. He's out with John Wesley Harding, I think, as we speak. And, you know, I've been speaking to a lot of musicians I love and respect about doing some work together. So I think 2012 is going to be a really fun year.
Well, thank you for so much for taking the moment here and, you know, taking the time here.
You're welcome. Thank you, Kyle.
2011 interview there with Mike Mills, and we'll be right back right after this. Welcome back. It's Kyle Meredith. So now we're going to into the future of our past. Into 2018. That's the second time I spoke with Mike Mills. Now, what's funny about this interview, this was the 20th anniversary of the album Up, one of my favorite REM albums. Also the 10th anniversary of Accelerate at this point. We would actually do another interview that we'll hear later on in this special where we talked about the 25th anniversary of Up. So you're going to get a double dose of Up. As I said, it's one of my favorite records. I love it so much. I said, let's do two of these interviews. So that's the setup right there anyway. Part two of Kyle Meredith with Mike Mills and REM.
So we're in Louisville. I noticed that you were just at the Derby again, right?
I was. I come as often as I can to help benefit the Unbridled Foundation and have a good time while doing so.
Yeah? Do you walk away with anything money-wise?
No, I did okay at the Oaks. Hopefully came close to breaking even by the end of it all.
That's about the best we can all hope for. So to break.
That's all I can ask. Yeah.
So there's 3 years I kind of want to hit on, and they all end with eight: 2018, 1998, and 2008. I thought we'd spin the wheel and I'd let you decide where we go first.
Given my memory, 2018 is probably the best start.
We'll start with the present then. Lately, I noticed you've been doing sort of messing around in the classical world, a concerto for violin, rock band, and string orchestra. I'd love to know what that's about.
Well, my very good friend Robert McDuffie came to me a few years ago and said that he could play Beethoven and Tchaikovsky until his hair fell out, and he'd rather try something different. And he asked if I would write a half-hour concerto for as you said, violin, rock band, and string orchestra. Bobby and I have been friends since grammar school, actually, early high school. And so I gave it a shot. It's really not, strictly speaking, a classical piece. It's more of a song suite. But it does have the elements that define a concerto, which is that it's about a half-hour piece of music that relies heavily on the virtuosity of the soloist, in this case, Bobby McDuffie. And, you know, it's something we really enjoy doing. We work a lot with youth orchestras when we play it around the country, as well as other symphonies. And, you know, we're just trying to show people that the gap between classical and rock and roll might not be quite as wide as people think it is.
And I think I've used that term, heard that term a lot too. You know, the line from Beethoven to the Beatles. It's, as you say, it's pretty small.
Well, yeah, I think people are surprised when they see this, because they might be expecting one thing and they get a really great combination of, I think, you know, some of the best parts of classical and rock and roll.
Now, I know you're you know, enough years away separated from REM to have that in the rear view, but this still has to seem like such a different world and a different setup for you, or does it?
Well, you know, it is, in fact, because most of the venues so far in which we've performed are classical music venues. We have done shows, you know, we work with these string orchestras. We've played with the Toronto Symphony, which is very intimidating. So it is it's not brand new ground, but it hasn't really been done that often that we try to combine the Venn diagram between the two types of music. So, you know, it's a little bit of uncharted territory, but we're making it work.
Now, outside of this, I mean, what do you keep yourself busy with lately, music-wise? I mean, are you still working in the rock world? I know a handful of years ago, you and I have a mutual friend with Joseph Arthur, so, you know, you'd been on tour with Joe. And but are you doing anything else in the rock world right now?
You know, I do some charity stuff. I of course, enjoy playing golf, so I try to combine charity music events with golf events. Patrick Warburton has a huge event every year out in the desert that raises a ton of money for St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. I'll actually be doing another event for St. Jude in early June in Memphis that Steve Cropper is hosting. So, you know, those things are really fun for me to do good work and have a good time doing it. We're hoping the Baseball Project can do a run of shows late this summer, if Scott McCoy is feeling up to it. So, you know, there are fingers in different pies here.
Gotcha. I know Scott right now is with Joe and Peter Buck. Joe, see, to me, Joe is just slowly putting REM back together in the most long way around possible. So,
well, you know, I've been a fan of Joe's for a long time, as you know, and, you know, I haven't heard he and Peter's work yet, which is slack of me, but I will be listening soon, and I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, it's a really great record. With the REM world, because there seems to be relevant news, Scott Aukerman and Adam Scott's REM podcast, have you been keeping up with that?
I'm aware of it. Adam and I communicate occasionally. I have not had the time to sit and listen to it yet, but I'm very much looking forward to it. He's a funny guy.
This seems like also, you know, an interesting way for a new audience still to find REM after all these years, you know, maybe not coming in the entrance from one of the big hits like a lot of us made it. I don't know if you've seen any impact from that, or even if that crosses your mind, like where the new generation, how the new generation finds your old work.
Well, you know, it certainly brings some new fans to the fold, I think, or reinforces for a lot of other fans that they're not the only ones that like it. It's really nice of someone of Adam's stature to make a point of talking about it. You know, music is always out there. I came to a lot of music later on myself. You know, there are a lot of ways that you find out about music, and not all of it is from the radio, fortunately, or satellite radio, or whatever the coin of the realm is currently. But it's really good that that people encounter music in unexpected ways.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, as far as that band goes, and, you know, I follow you pretty closely on Twitter. I like keeping up and liking the things that you're saying, because with the current White House, I keep thinking, though, isn't it a shame there's no new REM record? And I know that's not even in the pie right now, but oh, the things I feel like you all would be saying right now.
Well, it's true. Social media certainly is a double-edged sword, but at least it gives people a chance to speak their mind, state their opinions, and you know, you can engage with like-minded people, or you can have hopefully intelligent discussions with people who disagree. Yeah. And you know, Twitter itself is a very instantaneous method of doing that. You know, I enjoy the give and take. It's also nice to be able to vent. And, you know, I just think everyone should have a political opinion, and I think everyone should be involved in politics. And I think the more Americans that do participate, the better the result we're going to get is.
As far as, though, you know, on the writing, do you find yourself writing about any of this? Do you work on solo music in that way?
I tend to concentrate more on the instrumental and melodic side of music. I enjoy lyrics and I enjoy words, but I often find myself hitting a wall when I try to write them myself. But yeah, I mean, that's why a lot of times I say the things I have to say in social media rather than writing songs about it, because I don't always feel that I express myself as well with lyrics. But certainly, you know, there's plenty of material to draw upon these days.
Well, we'll spin the wheel a little bit. I want to head back 10 years because Accelerate just celebrated its 10th anniversary. I always feel like this is a record that sort of gets lost in the bigger REM conversation right now. And see if we can jog your memory a little bit, because at the time, for various reasons, this was sort of called the comeback album, the rock album. In retrospect, is that a fair assessment?
You know, given the inevitability of people needing to put labels on things, I think that's as fair as any. You know, obviously, none of us were thrilled with Around the Sun. It started out really well, and we made the mistake of trying to do a tour in the middle of making a record. You know, we learned a lesson from that, which is that once you start a record, you need to forge on through to the end. You know, by the time we got back from the tour and tried to finish Around the Sun, we'd sort of lost focus and weren't exactly sure where we were going with it. So it ended up being a bit meandering as far as we were concerned. So when we did Accelerate, we decided to make the songs as short and punchy and powerful as possible. We edited ourselves very, very heavily, more so than we've ever done before. And, you know, we just wanted to make it pithy. And so we had to say, get in and get out. You know, Peter and I have always agreed that there's very little more powerful than a 3-minute pop song or rock song. So that's kind of what we shot for with that.
And it does have one complete sound. I mean, at the time, I don't think you guys had done that since maybe Monster. Monster seemed to have that one combining sound that went all the way through it. But this one, for a band that is so creative and you did so many different sounds throughout the years, it seems like to me it'd almost be a challenge to have one cohesive sound run all the way through a record like that.
Well, that's actually very well said. You know, for anybody that's been doing their craft for years, you have to branch out and experiment and try different things. And we certainly did that, you know, to varying degrees of success. And when we got together with this, and we said, this has to be focused. This has to be tightly focused and laser sharp. And you know, and that in itself is a challenge, especially when you haven't done that for a few years.
You know, looking back when Collapse In and Out and the breakup was announced and everything, you had talked about how you had known it was coming for a few years. Did you know that the end of REM was coming during Accelerate? Because when I look at a song like Until the Day Is Done, it seems like it's spelled out perfectly for everybody.
No, we weren't really aware of it at that point. We became more aware of it as the tour went on, the 2008 tour. If you want clues in songs, they're on Collapse Into Now. Mm-hmm. There are two or three songs on that record that address the coming disbanding. But really, when we were making that record, we were just trying to reestablish ourselves to ourselves, not so much to anyone else, but to ourselves as a tight rock unit, and you know, just prove to ourselves that we still had the force to pull it together to make a great record.
I want to cheat a bit here, because you did bring up Collapse Into Now. Well, I did actually, but did you ever wish that album had been able to be toured? Because it's, you know, it never got the live chance in the way the others did.
Well, you know, I suppose that it would have been a cool thing, but I don't really have any regrets about it, because we were pretty sure that the 2008 tour would be the last one, and we never had any plans to tour Collapse Into Now. It was a record that was made to sort of say goodbye with. You know, we didn't want to do the tour where everyone knew it was the last tour. You know, we didn't want to do one of those big farewell things of all sentimental and maudlin, and like, oh, we're going to miss you guys and all that stuff. We just wanted to, you know, make our statement, put the record out, and then say goodbye.
Well, I do want to jump back in 10 more years further just for a moment here to talk about Up, which is getting its 20th anniversary this year. First off, this is one of my favorite REM albums. Up, I absolutely love. I might have listened to it more than any other record in your catalog.
Wow. Well,
but from what I understand, it was sort of a difficult record to make. Is that right?
Well, it didn't start out that way. I mean, you know, we started working on the songs with Bill and the band, and then we found out that Bill didn't want to be in the band anymore, so that left us with an option. We could either stop or we could keep going, and Bill insisted that we keep going. He said, look, I'm not going to be the guy that broke up REM. So we decided to go ahead and make a record, and we figured since we didn't have a drummer, we would go machine and use machines for the most part. Obviously, Barrett Martin did a great job on Lotus, but we wanted to just say, look, okay, everything's changed. All the rules are out the window. Let's try something completely different here. I'm really happy with Up. It was a lot of fun to make what for REM was an electronica record. Certainly Kraftwerk might disagree with that, but for us it was a lot of fun to be machine oriented. Musically it was a lot of fun. The dynamics of the band had obviously changed. You know, without Bill as a balancing force in the band, all of our quirks and foibles became a little more obvious to each other, and you know, we just had to reestablish the balance of being in a band together. And that was something that, you might not want to do that while you're making a record, but nonetheless, that's the hand we were dealt. So we got through it very well, and I'm pretty proud of that.
There are songs on there that sound nothing like you all had ever done before. I mean, starting it off with Airport Man is a statement in itself.
It really was. Well, that was my idea, which is, at this point, it was like, you know what, there was criticism coming in from some directions about things, and I said, okay, well, here it is. You know, we are not going to pander to anybody with this record. This is what we sound like, and this is probably the least pop song we've ever done, so we're going to make it first. And if you can deal with this, then you can deal with anything. I kind of enjoyed the contrarianism of that maneuver, but some people didn't like it as much.
Nigel Godrich helped you out with this. Did he have anything to do with those sounds? Because he's sort of known for that type of thing.
Oddly enough, the sounds came more from Pat McCarthy. Pat was an extremely talented man who has a lot of unusual ideas. And, a lot of the noises were keyboards and machines that Peter had found in looking through antique stores and garage sales. And we just gave Pat a free hand to say, here, make some noises and see what kind of sound beds you can make for us. So I think it was probably more Pat than Nigel, although Nigel was a big piece of the record. I think it was more Pat McCarthy.
Yeah. Well, I can't say enough great things about that record again. I mean, At My Most Beautiful and Day Sleeper, I mean, those are two perfect songs in my world. So, I appreciate all you guys did with that. Really do.
Thank you.
Well, that's our trip through time right there. I don't think we need to go back another 10 years to 88 at this point. That's been well tread many times over. So
you are correct.
It is a pleasure, Mike, talking with you and catching up. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much for taking the time. And I'll look forward to if you guys do the baseball project again. When that happens.
Well, I look forward to that, too. It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
And we'll be right back with Michael Stipe in just a moment. Welcome back. It's Kyle Meredith, and now we arrive in 2021. That's when Michael Stipe and Mike Mills drop by to talk about the 25th anniversary of New Adventures in Hi-Fi. That's Stipe, as you'll hear on this, he says, might be his favorite REM record. It's a tie with another one. We got to talk about writing the bulk of the record while touring the Monster album, the idea of spontaneity within the songs, and Stipe using religion as a writing tool. Hanging with Patti Smith, hearing Eddie Vedder and Jason Isbell cover them, and a whole lot more. Part 3 of Kyle Meredith with Michael Stipe and Mike Mills of REM.
Hello, Kyle.
Hey there. Hi there. How's it going?
It's great. Great to see you both on here. We're jumping, as you do these days, when you're together in the time machine, heading back to 1996, talk about a little record over my shoulder called New Adventures in Hi-Fi, which has got the big deluxe edition that's coming out. And just one of the greatest albums of all time. I know, as the story goes, a lot of these songs were recorded on the Monster Tour. It ended up being a road record that wasn't typically a road record, but I hope this, I'm going to start with a very heady question, I guess is where I'm going here. The road as a backdrop, as a character. We're told about albums that are kind of snapshots of artists, but this one really does, even now, more so now, feel like a snapshot of America, of life at the time. I'll sort of toss this one up to whoever wants it. As you look back on it, what is the world that you captured?
I was never an autobiographic writer, and this record is the same. I was kind of in the very, very, very beginning, because I just wrote what I knew. And then I realized that I didn't want to do that anymore. This is not at all a record about a band on the road or my experience being in a band on the road. Although we did work up, the guys worked up a lot of the arrangements and a lot of the songs while we were on the Monster Tour, and played them at sound checks and in the dressing rooms. And I was in the next dressing room over listening. The really great thing for me is that I was able to, the melodies, the music seeped into my DNA over that year and a half. And I had a lot more a lot more headspace, a lot more brain space to think about the lyrics and to work on those after the tour was over. I was focused during the tour really on every performance that night and not so much on trying to land pop songs for the next album. So most of the work that I did, most of my contribution came after the tour was done. Thematically, the record is a lot about people, about movement. It's got this velocity to it from song to song. But a lot of that had to do with my abandoning New York in the early 90s and following my best friend to Los Angeles, moving to LA and kind of, in a way, living and discovering the American West for the first time. And then it's a place where Peter Buck came from. His grandfather, Mike, correct me if I'm wrong, was the sheriff of LA County.
Police officer in Lancaster, California.
Well, so maybe I did a little Buckland exaggeration of his story there. But there was a lot of history and a lot of stories that I could tap into, and a kind of new way of looking at not only America but the world. And I use that to good end, I think. Yeah.
You know, in looking back and talking about this record, it has occurred to me this is a record about transition. Both the literal transition of us being on the road and going from city to city, which is, you know, directly referenced in one song at least, but certainly infuses the record, but also transitions that we weren't aware of. It's the transition that Bill, it's the last record with Bill in the band. It's a transition into a new record contract. It's just record of movement and change. And I think that's one reason it works. And that's one reason that it's okay that the songs are all very different and it really leaps from one type of song to the next. There's not a lot of cohesion on this record except for the feeling of movement. And that's what ties it all together.
Well, I kind of almost, there is cohesion. I completely agree with everything you said, but we have to state this was not about us. This is not a record about a band touring, right? I mean,
transition was just with the element around what we were doing. It wasn't about that at all. It was just something that infused its way into the record.
Well, that infusion, I think, is profoundly important because you can really feel it in the tracks. What these guys were doing, you know, we were in this hyper adrenalized state, being on tour and performing every night or every other night. And you feel that in the music. It creates this bristling landscape for me to people with the narrative arcs and the characters that I invented. It remains my favorite REM album. It remains my favorite record of any record that we made. Now, it has recently in the past couple of years been joined in the number one slot by Reveal. I have to admit, I have a soft spot in my heart for that record. But New Adventures in Hi-Fi is absolutely my favorite record of us, most definitely of us as a four piece.
Yeah, I remember the first time I heard it, and it went with every record that you all had done. I think as a lot of artists will say, you know, as sort of a reaction to the last record. But this one, I think, was the most drastic, like coming off of Monster, which, real quick, personally speaking, was a record that literally changed my life. A day in 1994 when someone slipped some headphones over me and I heard Bang and Blame in a very rural town in the middle of the Kentucky nowhere, my life changed. So Monster became a very important record. And then hearing this one, like, it's even more surprising hearing that so much of it was sort of created around Monster for it to be so drastically different musically speaking. And there are those moments where I feel like they do talk to each other, but where did that come from? I mean, here you are doing this, you know, sort of glamish thing on stage, and then to go back and the music wasn't that.
I like the way you said that, the dialogue between Monster, the record that we did before that, the tour itself, and this album. You definitely hear it in The Wake Up Bomb. There's that ironic distance that we borrowed really from. You know, Peter had moved to Seattle and bought a house with his wife at the time. And Kurt and Courtney literally bought the house next door. They shared a fence. I mean, they could look into each other's windows. And he became friends with all those guys. And so suddenly there was this really exciting thing that was happening in Seattle that Peter was a part of. And we had that. But we also had, you know, U2 had released Octoon Baby and Zooropa, and were applying this ironic distance to themselves to be able to kind of knock themselves down as celebrities and as public figures and as big pop stars. And that had a profound impact on me as a lover of music, also as a friend of those guys. I thought it was fantastic what they were doing, and it was my favorite thing that they'd done. So we took that same kind of ironic distance accidentally, I think. I don't think we did it on purpose, Mike, but using glam rock as kind of a base, that's what Monster became, and that's what the presentation of Monster on the road in 95 became. In the background, we had moved beyond that. We were already on to the next thing and trying not to repeat ourselves. And in doing that, we wound up writing, you know, as I said, my favorite record of us as a four piece.
Yeah. Being up there writing them like that, though, like, I think I've heard, maybe it was in the liner notes, you all talk about like the spontaneity. Was that exactly, because when you're in a studio, I guess what I'm getting to, when you're in a studio, you have all the time in the world to work on a song, to change a song, to decide when a song ends. But doing it in this way, did a lot of that kind of, did it allow for a lot of that spontaneity to leave in there, both musically and with the lyrics?
I have to say, Kyle, when you're in the studio and you're the last guy to turn in your homework, and you have Mike Mills, Peter Buck, and Bill Berry staring you down from the couch behind the control, you don't have all the time in the world at all. There was a lot of pressure. And, you know, that we can look back on it and laugh, but it was intense at the time for sure. And these guys were always very loving and very thoughtful about the pressure that they put on me. But it was a high pressure situation. They had done their part; they were finished, except for the arrangements and then helping me, you know, with background vocals and such to support the vocal. But they were kind of done and twiddling their thumbs at one point. The onus was on me to now take what they had created and try to not bring it down, but bring it up, to lift it higher.
Yeah. You know, spontaneity is great when you can get it, but you can't just produce a song spontaneously. Sometimes you get lucky, like How the West Was Won, certainly one of my favorites on that record. Literally, it was like creation ex nihilo. Bill Berry was playing a little drum part while I was sitting at the piano. I literally started playing that song, and it was written in about the 3.5 minutes it takes to play it. It was done, at least as far as the drums and piano part. So that was super spontaneous. And in keeping with that, I did the solo. Solo, that's a mighty nice word for what that piano piece is. But I tried to pretend like it was some guy we just dragged in off the street who'd never played piano before and said, okay, do something one time. You get one take. That's it. And that's what we did. And so what's on there, I'm not an improvisational piano player. I don't have riffs or licks on the piano. So I just sort of winged it. And I tried to lean on Thelonious Monk's dictum that there are no wrong notes. And, you know, tried to apply that to this. And literally it was one take. And I said, that's it. That's all it gets.
Yeah. And one of the greatest moments, you know, in your career right there, just when it all arrives like that. There is I've heard you talk about that in the documentary too, that comes along with this. And again, I'll mention the deluxe edition of the album Over My Shoulder that comes with all of this. But there's, Michael, there's also a point in there where you say that there is a lot of religion on this record, but I hope nobody asks about it because it's not exactly what you think it is. But there is a lot of references. And I started thinking about religion as a writing tool, something that you had used before. And I was wondering if you could talk a little about that, because it seems like it's a very helpful tool to use when you need it.
Well, it's a world that Mike and I both grew up in and grew up through, and it infused itself into our beliefs and the way that we treat each other, the way we treat other people. But I'm not a follower of scripture. That said, there's a lot to tap into when you're dealing with these giant themes or trying to take giant themes and kind of push them into a story that is then relatable and translatable to an audience, right? I'm thinking specifically of Undertow, I guess. And there's a degree in that song of denial on the part of the main character, where in the last line he accepts that he's drowning and he says, "I'm just going to give up and let this be what it is. I'm going to be like the birds that he references throughout the song." But then in the last line, he says that his body, like all bodies, have to breathe. And so he'll just start breathing water. And it's a leap of faith. That's like, okay, wow, you were an atheist up until that last moment. And then you kind of lost it at the end. And it's quite beautiful. Nick Cave, who else? I mean, there are so many people that tapped into scripture to create incredible careers. Nick Cave is the one person I can think of that really, the exemplary example of that. But it's something that I didn't necessarily want to overtly tap into. But and I also, I love writing from perspectives that are not mine. It pushes me as a creative person to do, I hate that term. Ugh. It pushes me as a writer to place myself in places that I do not belong and try to see things from a different perspective. That's maybe part of being a Capricorn. You know, I smell like a goat, but I also have some of those kind of climb the mountain slowly tendencies and wanting to see every situation from every possible perspective. It also, I think, Mike, makes me maddening to work with sometimes. But anyway, yeah, enough about me.
It's all about the results.
Did I start that sentence with the word I?
Maybe. There's some interesting parallels I'm drawing to the other anniversary that's happening, which is 10 years ago. And I think it's a few anniversaries. But 10 years ago, you all put out your final record, fantastic, Collapse Into Now. You get the greatest hits. The final song we hear even is Hallelujah as we talk about religion. You know, we get to there. And they even share Patti Smith. You know, I think that's the other big moment here, which, you know, you get her on Blue on Collapse Into Now. And then you get her on, what is it? It's Ebo, right? That's the one she's on. And I don't know. I'm just all praising Patti Smith here in case we want to do that a second. But Michael, on the documentary, you talk about just wanting to reach out to her. And I think that was the first time, but I didn't get to hear about what that actually was like. I mean, you finally get to meet her. Here's one of your heroes. What was that moment for you?
Well, we met over the telephone. I called her from a phone booth in a hash bar in San Sebastian, Spain, jet lagged as I've ever been in my life. And we were there with a bunch of friends that were there to celebrate the beginning of the European tour. Doug Copeland was there. Jane Pratt was there. Nena Cherry and her whole family, my goddaughters, were there. Richard Linklater was there. I mean, it was super weird, but we were, and my two best friends, Tom Gilroy and Jim McKay, both writers, directors, were there. And we ran into these anarchist film students and wound up in a hash bar on Valentine's Day, 1995 in San Sebastian, Spain. Mike and I had arrived from Singapore. We were insanely jet lagged. I had just written Departure, which, because I had this experience on the plane on the way there. So I was feeling really good about myself. And Fred Sonic Smith had recently passed away. And we knew Patty, although we'd never spoken or met each other, through Scott Litt, who was our producer, who had worked with Patty and Fred on Dream of Life. And I told him I wanted to reach out to her. She had to feel very alone. And so he asked her if it was okay to give me her number, and she said yes. So I called her, and I just said, you know, I'm sure that this is a difficult day for you, but I just want you to know that, you know, there are people in the world who are thinking about you, and I'm one of them. Later that year, the band went through Detroit, and we played several months later, I guess. We played in Detroit, and Patty and her two children were living in the outskirts of Detroit. And I went to visit them on a day off, and that was the first time we met.
Yeah, just incredible how it all comes around. And you get to be with your heroes, which is always a nice part of this job, the perks of this job anyway. I want to quickly catch up to I know we're running out of time here, but just the present really quickly. Michael, first off, I love the stuff that you've done with Aaron Dessner, with the one track we heard so far with, we played it a lot over here at WFPK, and it's fantastic. And then I go to put the Flag Day soundtrack in the other day, and there's Ed Vedder doing Drive. And you've got Jason Isbell doing a couple of tracks on his new record with Night Swimming and Driver 8. I mean, people have been covering you guys for years and years and years, but to have these artists doing it, I mean, were you tipped off beforehand? Do they call you and say, hey, is this okay? Or do you listen to this beforehand?
With Eddie and Sean?
Yeah, with Ed and Isbell too.
Yeah, Jason, I don't know, Mike, did we know that Jason was going to do that? We knew that he had set a goal for himself if Georgia went blue.
An album of Georgia songs, yeah. Yeah, and I knew there was going to be, I knew Driver 8 was going to be on there. I didn't know he was doing Nice Women. That was interesting.
His melodic take on Driver 8, the way he phrases, the way he rephrases certain lines, it makes me actually jealous. I listened to it several times and sang along. It was super great. And I wrote him a note. I've never met Jason, but I wrote him a note to tell him how grateful we were that he had done such a beautiful job with those songs. With Sean Penn and Eddie Vedder, we're great friends with Ed. So he reached out to say, look, I don't know if this is insane, but I'm going to do this. And are you okay with it? And what can we have it for the movie if it turns out good? And I said, without even, and we always check in with each other, but I knew where Mike and Peter and Bill live on this type of subject. And I said, you have our blessing, like, please do whatever you want with it. I'm thrilled with the idea that people now feel comfortable covering R.E.M. because for the longest time, we seemed like the most uncoverable band. And maybe it's the material, and maybe it's, I don't know what the subject matter, but people didn't really go there, and now they are, and that feels super good.
It is weird. There's something odd about the amount of time that it takes for, or it took for us to go from being, you know, however popular we were while we were extant as a recording unit, to the time when people felt comfortable recording us. And I always wondered why it didn't happen more often. I didn't lose any sleep over it, but I did wonder why. And now it's everywhere. I mean, there are people, you know, people as famous as Jason and Ed doing things. There are a lot of people I've never heard of that are doing really fun, unusual covers of R.E.M. songs in genres that I wasn't even familiar with. And it's very exciting. It's really cool to see your stuff reimagined by an entire new generation of musicians.
Yeah. I hum Airport Man, you know, at least once or twice a week. So that's not covering, but I'm covering it around the house anyway. So
if you're able to hum Airport Man, you're a better man than I am, Kyle. talk about openers for albums. I mean, we thought How the West Was Won and Where It Got Us was a weird one. And Mike, we also, when we played that that show in D.C. for the Tibet House, Tibet Freedom. We opened with Airport Man, right? Yeah. Like a 6-minute mm-hmm. version, and I'm in a fucking sarong. I mean, what were we thinking?
Well, we're contrarians, you know. We kind of always have been, and we just really chose to expose that side of our nature for those two records.
Yeah, thank goodness, because again, it's some of my favorite work that you guys have done. I'll just quickly ask then, what comes next? Is there more music? I mean, Michael, you've been putting out the stuff. Mike, either one of you got stuff on the way that we can, you know. I'm a greedy bastard. I'm a fan. That's what is happening right now.
Yeah. Well, the Baseball Project is doing a new record in January. I'm writing songs with a couple of different groups of people. I have two things coming out next year. A lot of shows where we combine classical and rock and roll. The concerto I wrote is being played at the Met in New York, which is very exciting. And we're going to be doing we're going to be touring a thing where the first half of is something called R.E.M. Explored, which is two great arrangers taking five R.E.M. songs and completely deconstructing them and turning them into something. I don't even know what it's going to be because I haven't heard it yet. Second half of the concert will be my concerto with full orchestra. Very exciting stuff. And then we have something called A Night of Georgia Music, which is I curated songs either about Georgia or by Georgia artists, and it's all instrumental, but it relies on the virtuosity of Robert McDuffie, the violinist, and Chuck Lavelle, the pianist. And it's a very exciting hour of Georgia music.
Awesome. Well, I can't wait to hear all the stuff that does come from, you know, whatever the future holds from both of you. In the meantime, we got the beauties like this right here, New Adventures in Hi-Fi, again, the deluxe edition. It's so much fun digging in deeper with all of this and the B-sides and all that. Guys, thank you so much for 40 years worth of music, and thank you for taking the time to talk about it today. This really meant a lot to me.
Thank you. Thanks, and stay tuned. There's more coming for sure.
Awesome. All right. Take care, fellas.
All the best.
And now we arrive to the final piece of this Rewind Special 2023. Mike Mills, as I mentioned earlier, stopped by this time, the second time, to talk about 1998's Up from REM, one of my favorite records of all time. You've already heard me say that, but in case you paused this, ran away, and came back in the middle, that's where we left off. So this now is the 25th anniversary of Up once we recorded this. It was their first post-Bilberry album. Found them trying out those new electronic bass sounds. We talk about some of the songs. We talk about also the Monkees' Mickey Dolenz and Soccer Mommy covering them. And their music being in The Bear, that show. Let's do this part four of Kyle Meredith with Mike Mills and REM.
Hello there. Man, three a week. That's hard work.
Yeah, it's, you know, and all the rest of them are just me biding my time to get back around to when you guys have another anniversary coming up so I can do another REM interview. So
thank you.
This time we get to talk about a little record called Up. Came out in 1998. It is my favorite REM record.
Whoa. Okay.
Yeah. And now whether it's the best REM record, I think that's a different thing, you know, whatever that means, but it's my favorite. It's the one that means the most to me. It's an album that doesn't get talked about enough, and probably an album that when it does get talked about, I always feel is a misunderstood record. And I don't know, you know, so there's a new deluxe edition. It's got this great live album that goes along with it from the Party of Five show. But just kind of going back there, before I get too deep in it, you know, I don't want to project too much. So I just want to kind of open it up to you. 25 years later, for all this record was, what does it mean to you?
Well, it's kind of a powerful record in terms of memory, because it was made under such difficult circumstances. You know, the story's told and known that Bill had left the band, and you know, we were already leaning towards making a more electronic, machine-driven record. Obviously, Bill's leaving accelerated that process, but you know, it was a record. Most bands would have been smart and taken a little time off, and you know, regathered themselves and determined how they were feeling after losing a member. But we were a stubborn bunch, and we said, you know, we've already started this record. We got demos. We got songs we like. Let's just do it. And so we made a really remarkable record under remarkably difficult circumstances, especially considering that what we decided to do was throw out all the rules that we had. Any previous guidelines or restrictions that we put on ourselves all went out the window. So it was liberating in that sense, but it was also terrifying in the sense that we didn't have anything to really fall back on. It was just it was kind of like a high wire without a net. So I'm really proud of it, and I thought that because of that, because there were so few bedrock foundations to stand on, it became even more interesting because it's so different than anything we did before.
Yeah, and that's what stood out to me. I mean, you know, because of my age, I mean, I remember coming around with Automatic and Monster meaning a lot. That opened a lot of doors for me, and New Adventures was great too. And we got to talk about that last time. When this hit, there was something in the air. There was something in the air that people were doing. Radiohead was doing it a little bit, you know, and some other bands with electronics. You guys did it in a very different way because there was this very organic sound to these electronics. In fact, when I listen to it now, what really stands out to me is this 60s vibe. And I was thinking, you know, when you have the younger generations come around and they're like, oh, we're discovering our own 90s. I always think that they forget about that there was this version of the 90s where, you know, you all were kind of looking back at the 60s. Like there's a little go-go in there every now and then, you know, there's some of that stuff. Like where did that, I mean, it may have just been the stuff you grew up on, but did you know that sound was there when you were doing it?
You know, we didn't know what was there when we were doing it. We were just winging it. But I will say this one thing about that record and about REM songs in general. There is usually one guy with a guitar or one guy with a piano at the core of most of them. So even though these songs are very, you know, electrified or mechanized or however you wish to describe it, there's still a real organic song at the core of almost all of it. And that makes a difference. It's not like we just started making noises with machines and you know, came out with these series of sounds. They are real songs underneath all of that. So I think that makes a difference and gives it a stability. What little stability it has comes from that. And the organic, what organic feel it has also comes from the fact that there is a song, a really basic, simple song underneath all of it.
Yeah. Now, does that go for the same with Airport Man? Because what a flex that was.
No, Airport Man is I don't know what Airport Man is. It's kind of it's like a dream sequence to me. It's like a person in a daze. It's like when you've been through too many airports, you know, and you're wandering through this airport and you're like, which airport am I in? Why am I here? Where am I going? Where have I been? I don't know any of these things. So, you know, it's such an odd song for REM. And we were in such a weird contrarian mood with everything we'd been through at that point. I said, why don't we just start the record with the weirdest song we've ever made? And our feeling was, okay, here's the new REM. This is not like the old REM. If you can appreciate this song, then you'll really like everything else. You know, it's kind of like, welcome to the new world. Here's the gateway through which you have to pass to get to it. And so we put it up there first just to let people know kind of what was coming.
Yeah. We got to talk about it in our last interview with you and Michael. But that's a song I frequently hum. I find it so comforting to hum that song, which is about all you can do with a song like that too, is just kind of hum along.
You know, it is oddly soothing in a way, except for the weird bah, 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 the weird noise that comes in there. But otherwise it's dreamy, which I kind of dig about it.
I feel like the other side of that in the context that we're talking is Day Sleeper, which ends up being the first hit, which I find one of the most magical songs that I love to listen to. Like, you know, some songs have magic in it. But when you talk about what you're talking in that, it's dreamy. And then you have a song called Day Sleeper, you know, I mean, and the airports. And then you have that video of you know, the offices and all that. Like, it seems like if you can define it at all, that might be one of those things you look back on. Because usually when you write a song and maybe a little bit falls on Stipe's shoulders because he's putting the lyrics to it. But you don't know what you're writing about until much later. And then you go, oh, look, there was a theme. There was something happening there.
Right, you
know,
right.
Does that serve true for that?
Well, for that song, you know, I don't know. I think when we write the music, we usually have no idea what Michael's going to do with it. So, you know, there are a lot of songs we wrote that I thought would be these like supremely pop things that turned out to be not pop at all. And yet were probably better songs for it. And that's fine. You know, that was a lot of fun for us, was to write a song and give it to Michael and have no idea what, if anything, he would come back with. I think Day Sleeper holds together really well because it was one of the first songs that we recorded before things started getting really weird in terms of you know, the balance of the band and recording schedules and you know, who shows up early, who shows up late, that kind of thing. And that's when it all got a little crazy, which I think leads to a lot of the craziness on the record, which is all fine. But Day Sleeper is a little more cohesive simply because we hadn't fragmented at that point that like we happened to later.
Yeah. Was one of those other instances you were talking about not knowing, you know, thinking it was going to be one thing and it was the other? Was the Sad Professor fall into that? Because when I go back and I was watching the documentary, This Way Up or something, whatever it's called, and there you are, and you're playing the guitar, and you guys are writing it, and then Michael says he writes what ends up being the saddest song that he's ever written.
I thought there was a sad sweetness to it when I wrote it, and I thought Michael would pick up on that. I mean, you know, like I said, he can take songs in different directions, but I don't know where you're going to take that other than to sort of be kind of sad and sweet. There's only so many places you can go with that kind of song. I love it. It's one of my favorite songs that we ever did, really. I think, you know, Michael broke, talking about breaking the rules. Well, Michael broke one of the main ones, which is that you don't break up sentences over. You just don't break them up like he did. It's very disjointed, which is kind of like maybe the thinking of an alcoholic professor might be. But you really sort of have to pay attention to it to find out which words are connected and which ones aren't. So, you know, I just think it's a beautiful song and it's really sad, but I really like it.
Yeah. While we're talking about songs, the one I probably hit the most is Hope. I don't know why I'm drawn to that song. I know there was a little melody line there with Leonard Cohen, and maybe that's why, but that's the one I've always wanted to ask in just the general term of what we're talking about. Like, where did that song come from? Because, again, this is a complete electronic thing that's happening here.
You know, I was trying to remember what the genesis of that song was the other day, and I'm not sure I know. I'm sure Peter had something to do with it because, you know, anything that I didn't come up with, most of the time it was Peter. So but I don't remember what that was before it turned into what it is, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
It was always going to be some, it's a Pat McCarthy song as much as anything else. It was always going to be a very heavily electronified and mechanized song. And so we really, in a big way, turned that one over to Pat. So a lot of what you hear that isn't Michael is Pat McCarthy.
Mm-hmm. It's a cool track. And those, and you know, I could keep going on there too, because, you know, Lotus being one of those, it's kind of like that, you know, just bizarre, cool stuff that's happening. But then, you know, okay, fast forward 25 years and we get this box. And I was thinking about the way you guys have been doing these deluxe editions, because a lot of times they collect B-sides, live cuts and everything. This one doesn't quite seem like it. Like, there are songs. What did I write? The Emphysema and Surfing the Ganges. How do you say that? Ganges. Like, yeah. Those aren't part of it. Like, when you all talk about doing these deluxe editions, I think for the fans, we're like, oh, what's going to be on here that we haven't heard? This one doesn't exactly get that. What was the conversation about this one?
I'll be honest with you. It wasn't my idea. I like putting the demos on there, but it seemed like this was such a departure record for us. That just continuing to put out demos and outtakes and things, it just seemed a little out of character with this record. This record, because we had thrown out literally every rule we had when we made it, when we put it out, you know, we printed the lyrics, we just said there are no rules. So the other rules we broke were, well, we're not going to fill it up with outtakes and demos. We're going to give something completely different to maybe our most different records. So we put the, and also it's just in keeping with the bizarre nature of it, it's us on Party of Five. I mean, there's not too much weirder than that. So we just added the live show. And also there's an odd juxtaposition of putting a live show with our least live record. You know, it gives it a little humanity, a little organic feel that might not have been there if we just put out a bunch of demos.
Right. It's nice hearing the live stuff, because we didn't get to experience that in that way at the time.
Not for a little bit later, but, you know, those songs, like all of our songs, like I said, there's a song at the core of everything, which means that you can somehow reproduce it live one way or another.
Mm-hmm. Are there vault songs in that way? I mean, you know, in another 20 years, do we get to turn around and be like, okay, now we're going to start releasing all the songs you haven't? Like, do those even exist?
Oh, yeah. There's still plenty of stuff lying around. But, you know, there's a reason you haven't heard most of it. You know, I mean, I know as a fan, I'm always curious about outtakes and demos and things like that. But you have to decide if it enhances the knowledge of a song or if it diminishes it. And, you know, especially for the singers, Michael in particular, but even, you know, Bill and I trying to find parts in the background, it's like laws and sausages. You don't always want to see how they're made.
I know, you know, that's, of course. Yeah. Right. I know as the artist, that's how you feel. And that's how most artists feel about their work. And then you turn around, the Beatles are like, okay, you get everything. You get everything, everything. You get all the chatter in between, you get everything. And we're like, yeah, give us more still. We don't want
Well, you know, they were funny. You know, they have those accents. Of course, you want to hear them talk. I don't think we recorded a lot of chatter, so it's not like we're ever going to have the great experience that is the Love Show in Las Vegas, which I absolutely adore. I've seen it at least twice, if not three times. You know, that's a beautiful thing, and I'm so glad they captured all that stuff for us to listen to later. And you know, yes, there are a couple of really cool demos. From this record, Suspicion is on this record, right? Mm-hmm. Peter's demo of Suspicion is actually better than what's on the record, but it's got some things wrong with it that meant we couldn't use it. So, you know, that may see the light of day someday. It's even more atmospheric and beautiful than the one on the record, but who knows? Someday that'll probably find its way out.
Yeah. I mean, just one of those. I mean, there are bands. Pearl Jam comes to mind, The Lost Dogs. It was like, okay, we're not going to put these on an anniversary edition. We're just going to compile them all onto its own little album.
Yeah, I mean, we've done that before. We put out Eponymous, which was a collection of Lunacy and B-sides. And, you know, we don't have a problem doing that. But, you know, this just wasn't the time.
Right. Well, in the meantime, you've got other folks waving the flag for you. The Mickey Dolenz EP and Soccer Mommy. Also covering you guys on her new EP. Like, this feels like a nice time. Like, there's something, it's all coming together for REM.
Well, if you last long enough, you can become cool again. You know, the thing is, you first of all, you have to last long enough to become uncool, which we successfully did. And then if you continue to be in the ether, you'll become cool again. I noticed it when they started. I don't watch those, you know, The Voice and America's Got Talent. I don't really watch them, but I know that people started covering REM songs. You know, people were playing Everybody Hurts and a few other things. And I said, okay, that's it. We're on the way back. But, you know, you just got the feel that we were being rediscovered by a new generation of people who didn't know the baggage of us becoming uncool, of us, you know, the downward career arc, which happens to everyone. You know, a lot of people weren't familiar with that. We didn't have any baggage. So they said, oh, this is a cool song. I'll sing that. And that is kind of nice to see that having stuck around this long, people are rediscovering our stuff. And we're validated in the sense that when we made these records, one of our only overriding ethical ideas was that it be timeless. Mm-hmm. We really didn't want any record to have so much of the sound of the day that it sounded dated when you played it later. In fact, we had one of our only real problems with IRS was when we made Murmur. And they told, I probably shouldn't say this, but I'm going to say it anyway. They told Mitch and Don to update that snare sound and do these other things that made it contemporary early 80s. And Peter and I heard it and said, what the fuck are you doing? This is unacceptable. So we had to go back and remix a lot of it to get that 80s sound out of it. Even now, when I listen to Radio Free Europe, that snare sound bugs me because it's still got too much of that 80s feel. But my point is that, you know, because we wanted to make these records timeless, I think that's why they hold up now for people who hadn't heard them 20, 25 years ago.
Yeah. It's been fun too. The one thing I didn't mention was, of course, the Bear bringing back Strange Currencies, which, you know, fucking amazing song right there. I'm so happy it sort of got its moment in the sun. Did you all see that coming? I mean, that's got to be one of those moments that has to be a little bit of a surprise.
Well, it was a big surprise. You know, we've had lots of people asking us to use our songs over the years, and we almost always say yes. What's gratifying about this is that it's such an awesome show. It is such a great show. It's so well done. And the use of our music in it and other people's music is so spot on. Those guys really know what they're doing, and their love of both their craft and their art and the music that they apply to that is clear. And so that's what makes it work so well. And I'm thrilled that they chose to use our stuff as much as they have, and that it's such a great show. I haven't seen season two yet, but I understand that it's even more harrowing than season one, but also great.
You're in for something. You are. And it's renewed for the third season. So hopefully there'll be much more from you guys. And that's an easy way to wrap this up by saying what's next. You were just here in Louisville with the Baseball Project. Great to have you back in town as usual, but what happens next for you?
What is next? I leave tomorrow to head to Spain for a few big star shows. And really that's it. You know, the concerto thing that I wrote has several different, you know, we won an Emmy, by the way. I'm going to put that out there.
Congratulations.
A Night of Georgia Music, which is a part of it's one of the iterations of the concerto. It's a regional Emmy, but hey, it weighs the same as the other Emmy. So, you know, so I've got a lot of concerto stuff going on, but really it's been a busy year trying to keep next year a little bit more open, but we'll see what happens.
Yeah. Mike, it's always such a pleasure to catch up with you. I really do mean that. 25th anniversary edition of Up. I've waited 25 years to get to this point. So, and I can't wait for the anniversary of Reveal next. So that's still on the way.
Yeah, that's going to be fun. I'm actually looking forward to that too.
Yeah, man. It's great talking to you. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk about it.
Same to you, Kyle. Thank you.
And there it is, a rewind through, 12 years of interviews with REM. Always looking forward to the next one. So thanks to Mike Mills, thanks to Michael Stipe, thanks to Peter Buck and Bill Berry and the whole gang for all the music that they've given to the world. Thanks to you for checking out the episode. Before you get out of here, hit that subscribe button so you can get all the interviews that I put out every single week. It's a new one every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. You can grab us anywhere you get your podcasts from, including Spotify, Apple Podcasts, NPR, WFPK.org,
Consequence, YouTube for the video versions, or anywhere you get your podcasts, you can subscribe to Kyle Meredith With. Don't forget to give the series a rating and leave a review while you're at it. After that, you can head over to WFPK.org. It's where I do a show Monday through Friday starting at 6 p.m. Eastern. 4 hours of classics from the 80s and 90s, the best in new music, bonus interviews, lots of music news as well. One of my recent shows featured some classics and favorites from Bonnie Raitt, the Allman Brothers Band, Creedence, Relay, Collective Soul, Counting Crows, No Doubt, Janis Joplin, Los Lobos, Enigma, Avery Sunshine, Broken Bells, Dido, and my interview with Peaches. That's what you can hear weeknights starting at 6 p.m. Eastern at WFPK.org. Consequence has your music and film news. You can also find me on any of the social media sites. The address is always the same. It's at Kyle Meredith. I do hope you like and follow along. And that does it for another edition. I'm Kyle Meredith. I'll see you next time.
Consequence Podcast Network.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.